We have ignition sequence start.
Short distance, high impact.
5, 4, 3, 2, all engines running.
10 questions with Adam Zwar. Big names, great minds.
Make yourself a cup of tea.
Liftoff, we have liftoff.
Hello again. Today's 10 Questions features one of my favorite comedy performers, Mark Humphreys. You'd know Mark from his brilliantly observed sketches for The Roast on ABC 2, The Feed on SBS, and most recently for 7:30 on ABC. He's also hosted the Channel 10 quiz show Pointless, and along with his co-writer Evan Williams, has written a book called On Politics and Stuff, which is bloody funny. I don't want to generalize, but in comedy, people are generally scoundrels, but Mark's one of the decent ones. And sorry to completely embarrass him, but that decency shines through here. As usual, I started by asking Mark when he was most happy.
It was the 2018 Logie Awards. I love the Logies, and I know most people don't. I think most people in most Australians probably have a love-hate relationship with them, but which I think I do too. But I've grown up watching them. I'm fascinated by them. I actually want to do a podcast about the Logies. That's the sort of lockdown project I should get onto. I just think everyone who's been to Logies has an anecdote or more. And obviously, a lot of the anecdotes, the names will have to be removed. But generally speaking, I think there'd be some good stories. But yeah, no, I just feel like I'm sort of a child of television, and to me, the Logies is I was going to say the pinnacle, but I just mean it is a landmark within the TV landscape. And in 2018, I got to finally go. And it was just everything that I hoped it would be. And I got to, you know, I got to meet a bunch of people that I wanted to meet, and like Sean McAuliffe, and Bert Newton was on stage, like to be there when Bert was there. And, you know, I think Bert is obviously just, you know, he is Australian television. The after party and dancing till 3 a.m. and all that sort of stuff. And it was just the first time I sort of felt like I actually was part of Australian TV, even if just for one night, because everything I'd done to that point was sort of, it was on TV, but I was usually, you know, I've always been doing these little sketches. At that time, I just left SBS and joined Channel 10. And so at SBS, you know, Evan, my co-writer, and I, we just worked in a little corner in an office, just making our little sketches. Never really felt like we were kind of part of the TV industry, I guess. And so that was just one night where I just felt like, oh, I'm actually here and surrounded by it. And it was like walking into the television set that I'd been watching my entire life. It was magic.
It's important to note that Mark's love of television was first sparked by his father, who was ABC weatherman and reporter Alan Humphreys. As well as appearing on TV, Alan hosted The Country Hour on ABC Radio and also Gardening Talkback, where he was the first host to ever activate the 7-second delay dump button when a caller asked how he could get the best yield out of a marijuana plant without, quote, it growing so high that the coppers will spot it from over the fence. But back to Mark and how he got his own start in television. He takes up the story when he was in his early 20s. He had a degree in advertising and international relations and was feeling pretty disenchanted with his job in a warehouse.
I was just like, what do I do? I can't work in a warehouse any longer. I've done it long enough, and I'm kind of putting my life on hold. And I had studied advertising, actually. And so I called a recruitment agent and said, hi, I've got an advertising degree. I'm sort of working in a warehouse, but like I need to get a job in advertising, even though I had decided that I hated advertising. The recruitment agent said, it sounds like you hate advertising. And you should work in this industry. I was like, no, I don't want to work in it at all, but I just need to do something else. And they're like, what do you really want to do? I said, well, I'd like to write comedy. And they're like, well, have you tried interning on a comedy show? And it just had never even occurred to me. And also, we didn't really have any comedy shows at that time. And so the only thing that was really on at that time that seemed possible was Hungry Beast. So I was like, oh, okay, well, I guess I could contact someone there.
Hungry Beast was an ABC sketch show created by Andrew Denson and Andy Nell featuring emerging Australian talent, many of whom have gone on to have outstanding careers. And the week Mark spent as an intern on the show changed his life.
It was the first sort of foot in the door and getting enough of a taste of it to go, oh, I like this. This feels very comfortable. If I could make this work, then I'd be very happy. So I got to meet Andrew Denton, you know, all that sort of. I was incredibly nervous, but it was, yeah, he gave me 15 minutes of his time, and that was just heaven for a TV kid like me.
Same. He did that to me too. And if you're doing your Logies podcast, he's obviously one of the first people you should talk to.
I remember seeing an interview with Denton talking about the Logies where he just said something like, Bert Newton and Graham Kennedy made such a huge contribution to Australian TV, but I am sick and fucking tired of us eulogising them every year at the Logies. We've done so much since then.
So true. It's so true. Oh, God. Yeah, that one moment in time that we keep going back to.
That's like, yeah, it's funny, like, just like, you know, how many times can you watch the clip of, you know, I like the boy and all that sort of, or Graham's dog taking a piss. I mean, that's the funny thing to me. The greatest moment in Australian TV history is a dog taking a piss on camera. That's
not a joke. Nothing scripted.
No. just. You know, Graham had given the dog too deliberately given it too much water or what have you, and that's it, and that's our kind of, you know,
buoyed by his week on Hungry Beast, Mark then heard about a satirical news show called The Roast, and he was able to get the phone number of The Roast executive producer Charles Firth off an actor he was working with in The Warehouse. And then he just cold-called him.
I called Charles and said, I'd like to be a comedy writer. I've never done anything, but, you know, can I come and intern on this show? And he's like, yeah, sure. And so I'd turn up and my favourite thing, I don't do impressions, but my one thing is I can say Charles Firth saying yes, which is yes. and shit. That's the other thing that he says. Anyway, so I... turned up to intern on this show. Charles wasn't there, and Charles didn't tell Nick, the showrunner. So, but I didn't know that. I presumed everyone had been informed. So I just turn up and I, you know, start writing on this thing. Only later did Nick tell me. Yeah, I didn't know who the F you were. Charles didn't tell me shit. You know, like, I was very polite and just said, yeah, okay, you can write, but just like no one told me anything. So anyway, that was my entry into that, and I just sort of kept turning up until they put me on the payroll and went from there.
I think it's a little bit of a metaphor of how you get in the show business. You just like just turn up.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think it's weird. It's funny whenever there's always these conversations about, you know, if anyone ever wants advice about how do I get into and show business, but like, you'd know there's no path. There is, you have to absolutely forge your own, and so much of it is just weird chance and people you know and luck and all that sort of stuff. I mean, and then, but it's, you know, it's always a thing of luck meets, you know, determination or what have you.
After The Roast, Mark and his writing partner Evan Williams moved to The Feed on SBS, and that's when they worked their way into the nation's consciousness. But back to the questions: who would Mark like to apologize to? And why?
I don't think you'll find a more apologetic person than me. I always say that I've spent half my life apologizing to people and the other half waiting for apologies that never come. If I owe you an apology, you will have heard from me. Or if I haven't, do contact me, because I have no qualms about apologizing. I absolutely believe in, if I've done you wrong in any way, I don't want you to feel, I absolutely want to do whatever I can to try and, you know, make that better or you know, apologize. So I can't think of anyone specifically that I would want to apologize to, because I really do it an awful lot. I remember even when I was doing Pointless with Andrew Rochford, there was like something, we had to do a thing where it was like, it's almost like a dating game thing where it's like they asked us questions about, we had to answer questions about the other person. So I was answering questions about Andrew Rochford and he was answering questions about me. And the question was like, you know, what is the one thing that the other person does too much? And Andrew wrote, you know, I can't stop saying sorry. I'm always just trying to keep the peace. I'm really non-confrontational. I've absolutely, you know, fucked up many, many times, but just, I'm pretty sure that I've made efforts to apologize to the people that I think I need to.
Where does that come from, do you think? Do you come from a family of apologizers?
No, I don't really know where that comes from. I think I've always been quite wanting to please everyone, maybe. But I can't really pinpoint a particular, can't think of a particular moment. I think sometimes it might also be, there are a couple of things I can think of in my childhood where I was wronged and I was not apologized to. And I, you know, harbored that resentment. And so I think on some level kind of gone, well, if I made someone else feel that way, I wouldn't want them to be holding onto the thing I'm holding onto, I guess. So
that's nice.
Yeah. But look, I'm sure people could flood me with emails and go, mate, there's a fucking ton of things you can apologize for. I'm sure there are massive, you know, gaps, but generally speaking, I really believe in the power of an apology. So when people give them to me, oh my God, I'm so ready to move on. If you just did me wrong and then you apologize, I'm so ready to move on. But if you don't apologize, then it's just like, it just festers, you know? And then, you know, manifests itself in shingles. I don't know. Maybe that's the connection. I have shingles at the moment, in case it's not clear.
That's right. Mark has shingles, which is a reactivation of the same virus that causes chickenpox and manifests as a painful rash. So if you've had chickenpox, then you're a chance to get shingles, and it can sometimes be brought on by stress. And on the day we spoke, Mark did have a rash over his too handsome for comedy face. Moving on to question three, what is Mark's greatest regret?
It's so petty, but I think about it every day. It's the most stupid thing to think about every day, but I do. In 2015, I was going to New York for the first time on holiday with my dad. And I'm a huge musical theater fan, and I was so excited about going to Broadway and seeing shows on Broadway. And so a few months before I went, I was looking at what's going to be on Broadway when I get there. And I saw there was going to be I saw a bunch of things, and I went, okay, I'll get tickets to that and that and that. And then I was reading about a show that was going to be opening the week that I was going to be getting there. And it was described as a hip hop musical about the man on the US $10 note. And I thought, wow, this sounds terrible. So no, thank you. So did not purchase that. And Hamilton, had I known, I mean, I could, like, it is undoubtedly the biggest musical theater phenomenon of my lifetime, maybe. I mean, like, you know, Phantom was huge, Les Mis was huge, Wicked was huge, but Hamilton could top them all. And because Hamilton is such a cultural, you know, behemoth, I can't escape it. So I see Hamilton around me all the time. And it's on in Sydney. Obviously, we're in lockdown, but, you know, there are posters and people are always talking about it, and the cast and everything have all gone on to other things. So they're popping up in other stuff. And I could have been there. I could have seen it. I could have been one of the cool people who was at the forefront of that. And it's like, I saw it first, and I was, you know, I'm not just some bandwagon rider. And I have to live with that. So, you know, my own ignorance and lack of sort of open-mindedness. So since then, I'm sort of like, when I read about musicals that sound like they could be a bit weird, like American Psycho, the musical, I go, I'm there. I'll see it. It sounds great. That is my biggest regret.
What did you see in place of Hamilton?
Yeah, great. So I saw a revival of The King and I. which was very good. I mean, to be clear, it was a very good revival. I did see great things. I saw the original Broadway production of Fun Home, which was excellent. And if people are familiar with Fun Home, that's a marvelous show. So I'm glad that I got to see that.
To get closure, Mark did end up seeing Hamilton in London and loved it. Thought it was brilliant, but would now be quite happy for the whole thing to go away. Question 4, what would Mark still need to do to feel he'd lived a satisfactory life?
I wish it wasn't this, but own a house. For me, there's something about that which is just like, okay, like I have a little spot on this earth that's mine, I guess, if that makes sense. And I feel like, because I've got 2 children and wife, and that's to me just like, it's just, it represents stability and, you know, an element of the family unit and not that sort of constant thing of like, oh, do we need to be looking for a different place, or, you know, is the owner going to, you know, put it up for sale, or what, all that sort of stuff. So I think the problem, obviously the big problem at the moment, is it just feels so unattainable. There's just no clear pathway to home ownership for us at the moment, especially with the way that prices just keep going up and up and up and up and up. So I think that's something that causes me a little bit of angst. But if I could solve that, because I think, you know, when I got cast on Pointless, it was like, oh gosh, if this runs, you know, 4 years or something, I think I can do it.
Yeah.
And then it ended, you know, within one. I was like, God damn it. I thought I just got there. Yeah. Anyway.
We then talked about the perception among some that you could make good money on Australian television. And with the exceptions of a few superstars, you make about as much as you would if you're in middle management. But here's the catch. You only make that kind of money on the days that you're actually working.
I've read articles about how, you know, Vince Colosimo in between projects is working on building sites. And, you know, and you go, of course he is. Like, yeah. I think... the number of people who can actually make a sustainable career just off, you know, television gigs is, I don't know. Can you count them on, you know, 2 hands? I don't know. It's very small number. I think there is this perception that it's different. I had a thing even yesterday where someone was, I'm a writer on, there's a sketch show coming to Amazon called The Moth Effect. And, I was saying, oh, you know, here's the trailer for it. And someone replied, oh, you know, I'm not giving my money to, you know, I understand the whole thing, but I'm not giving my money to Bezos. Why aren't you doing it on the ABC or SBS? We don't have a choice. It's not some sort of, you know, it's some sort of buffet. Just like, oh, I think I'll go with ABC. I don't know. I could go Netflix, but no. Like, it's just whatever. You kind of have to take what you can get. You know, you really, beggars can't be choosers. Very occasionally something will happen where you just go, like, I won't do an ad for horse racing or gambling. Like, there's certain things where I can't morally do it. But generally speaking, you know, having morals is a privilege, I think, for you know, people in this industry.
Oh, mate, it's so true. The only ads I won't do are gambling and for the Liberal Party. But, you know, that's everything else I'm up for grabs. Sure. Call my agent, Aaron Michaelman. Who is the person who most influenced you and how?
The best answer I can come up with is maybe my French teacher from high school, Mr. Sheehan, just in terms of having the biggest, probably had the biggest impact on my life, just in the sense of giving me a passion for French, which then translated into me going and studying at a university along with advertising, and then going and living in France for a year in 2007, where I then met my now wife and have since had 2 children and everything. So I think that's a pretty good measure of influence. But then, like, you know, obviously, like, you know, comedy influences, you know, that we've all got, and you know, people, for me, just people like Martin Short and Norm Macdonald, the ones that I worship and try and, you know, extract something from, even though it probably doesn't come across. But yeah, that's, I think the French thing is probably the big one.
Do you speak fluent French?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, you know, I think it's certainly a lot weaker now, but my wife and I still speak French with each other. Not all the time. It depends. usually when we need to discuss something that we don't want the children to hear. But it's certainly, you know, gotten a bit rough. But anytime I go back to France, it usually comes back within a day or two. Or it's really kind of, it's that sort of thing of, like, I think the vocabulary is still there. It's the confidence that you kind of need to kind of, because I think speaking a foreign language is almost like adopting a persona. I felt like I had a different personality in French. I think I was actually a better person in France. I was a better listener because I had to be. You know, I can sort of hear, I can be a bit more of a loud mouth. But in French, it's like I've really got to focus. And so I think, yeah, I was a much better listener. And I mean, it also kind of changed my sense of humor. Like, because the French laugh at different things than we do. And so if I was trying to be funny the way that I would try here, just didn't play. Whereas they're much more play on words and that sort of, you know, puns and things like that. I hate puns. I'm just not a pun guy. But in France, you know, I remember the first proper laugh I got in French was from observing, it's so niche, but like there's a word about, it's called connerie, which I think sort of translates to sort of nonsense. And I made some observation about, like, oh, people must think that, you know, Sean Connery, you know, only speaks, you know, Connery. And it was like people fell out of their chairs. Like, it was like, I was like some, you know, savant. To me, you know, it was, you know, it's pretty ordinary line, but like,
oh, mate, no, I love it. And were you in Paris and were you studying? What was the deal?
I was in Bordeaux.
Oh, yeah.
And I was studying ostensibly, but I used the year more to just do a bunch of things that I didn't have the confidence to do here. And it, so, because I always wanted to do something in the kind of creative arts, writing and performing and what have you, but I was too shy to admit it here. I thought I was too embarrassed to kind of admit it in Australia. So in France, I was like, well, I'm only here for a year. I don't know anyone here. At the end of the year, I can leave and never talk about this or whatever, never see these people again. So why not just do stuff that you wouldn't normally do? So like I ended up joining a theater troupe and I did a couple of plays in French. I did some short films.
Wow.
So I kind of fell into a crowd like that. And once I had fun doing that, then I came back to Australia and said, well, maybe I could do something in that sort of space. But I also worked in a bar there. And so that was really good for the French, in terms of my language skills, having just, you know, serving people and speaking with clients and with customers. And it was the best year. It was the best year of my life. It was absolutely fantastic.
And what were you, like 21, 22?
20, yeah, that's right. 20, yeah, I was 21. So it was a perfect time. Bordeaux is very much a sort of university town. So a lot of young people around. And it's a beautiful, beautiful city.
Mark said Bordeaux is where he met his wife, Yulia. But how did he meet her? And where is she from?
She's from Russia. So she was there studying as well. And the first night that I was working in the bar, I invited a bunch of friends along to, I think my boss said I could give them half price drinks or something. I can't remember. But anyway, and I said, come along and, you know, I'll serve you and we'll have a good night and everything. And one of my Irish friends said, can I bring along my friend Yulia from Russia? And I was like, yeah, sure. And then I met this girl and it was that lightning bolt. It really was that lightning bolt moment where I saw her for the first time and I just immediately kind of froze. And I was so, it's going to sound so corny, but the way I describe it is that I felt like I recognized her because I'd seen her in my dreams. It was like, it was a very strange feeling. And because, and she was beautiful. And of course, because of that, I immediately went, well, I'm never talking to her. So I just kind of ignored her because it's just like, well, that's never going to happen. And I think that probably ended up ultimately working to my advantage that I was so disinterested or what have you. and not sort of, you know, going full on at her. And yeah, and so it went, you know, went from there. And then she ultimately, after her studies finished, I had to come back to Australia. She had to stay there for another 6 months to finish hers. And then she came over here.
And where in Russia is she from?
She is from Siberia. She is from a very small town in Siberia, which I have visited. And, you know, I went in summer, but it is one of those things where it gets down to minus 40, like just like insane temperatures that I'll never understand. It's the temperatures to the point where you go, why is there a town here? Just move. Like this is not a place to start a civilization. And you know, the Russian culture is so different. There's things that I've learned the hard way about that, about their whole approach to family. And grandparents are very kind of hands-on. Hence, Yulia's dad actually lives with us. I mean, he's terrific, but it was just something that I had to kind of, because my parents, they're around, but they're not. You know, Australian grandparents are kind of, call us when you need us. Russian grandparents are like, you know, arriving at the door with their suitcases. So,
What do they think of your comedy and satire? Do they understand? Do they understand the nuances of what you're doing?
I can't say with certainty that they know what I do for a living. I'm not sure. I really don't know, and I'm afraid to ask, so I don't bring it up. They probably think it's ridiculous. Like, because Yulia's father is very practical, like very useful, like a real handy man. He used to fly helicopters, and like he found a leaf blower in the street that was broken. He fixed it, and like, so he's simultaneously like the most popular guy in the house in terms of like the kids love playing with, but now probably the most loathed person in the neighborhood. He's brilliant. So because I don't have really kind of practical skills, so I think they probably don't think much of me. But I guess as long as the bills are paid and there's a roof over the heads, I guess they're okay with it.
When was the last time you cried and why?
Oh man, I'm such an easy crier. I mean, I cried yesterday. I was watching, I saw a clip from Cheers. Which made me cry. The one I'll tell you though was when I originally started writing these answers. I did some work. It was 3 days ago, and it was a thing which just gave me so much joy. Which was, it was a young woman in America. I think she was competing maybe in a musical theater competition or something, and she had to do a song. She's singing a song from Mean Girls, the musical, and there's a bit where she jumps on a chair for this kind of big moment. And as she goes to jump on the chair slides and slips out from underneath her, and she crashes onto the floor, but she does not miss a note and she keeps going. So the audience immediately is just like, you know, start applauding, but she keeps going and she's undoubtedly in some sort of pain. But she finishes that song for, you've got another 30 seconds to go, and hits all those notes and ends on the, you know, kind of, you know, arms lifted up at the air. And the sound of the crowd just wrapping her in a warm embrace, that ecstatic sound. When you hear a crowd really, absolutely, just completely give themselves to a performer, I find that very, very moving.
Me too.
And the other example I'll give of that, which is going to sound lame, but that's who I am. I have very lame taste, but the very first public performance of Riverdance occurred at the Eurovision Song Contest in 1994 in Ireland, and no one had ever seen anything like that. It's this 8-minute performance that is so powerful and bursting with energy and thrilling, still thrilling to this day to watch. And Michael Flatley leaps on there, and you've never seen anyone move like this and perform a dance like this. And there's a whole troupe of dancers with him, and there's the female lead as well, and they're both in sync with each other and everything. And when they do that final dance step and the final note, and then the audience just roars and leaps to their feet, and I tear up every single time I watch that. I really recommend that. It's very good for the soul. So I love A Cry. Big fan of A Cry.
Oh, mate, I'm going to watch that. I've not seen that. I've seen a lot of Riverdance, but I've not seen that, the first one. That would have been special.
The very first one, yeah, because people didn't know what is this? They'd never seen it. They didn't know what to expect. And I think it was also, it's that Irish pride as well. It's an Irish audience, and this is going out to the world. And, even just thinking about it, beautiful.
Riverdance premiered during the interval of the 1994 Eurovision Song Contest in Dublin and starred dancers Michael Flatley and Gene Butler. They performed the 8-minute routine in front of 4,000 people at the Point Theatre and 300 million television viewers worldwide. It was an immediate sensation, which expanded into a theatre show in 1995. Flatley became a star, and Butler insured her legs for £1 million, and then they fell out because, according to Butler, Flatley thought it was all about him. Moving on to question 7, what's Mark's current state of mind?
Because I've just been dealing with shingles for the last couple of weeks. I guess it's the state of mind of just like, is this the vessel that I've got to carry through with me till the end? Like, I feel like the human body, my state of mind is the human body is not, I think it's just not fit for purpose. I'm getting increasingly alarmed about the, I'm only 35, but already just, sort of the gradual breakdown that everyone experiences. And I had a melanoma removed a couple of years ago. Unfortunately removed in time, but it's left, a noticeable scar. And it's like, this thing is quite fragile. This thing that's sort of carrying us around is not really, built to last. Whenever I see like a 3-year-old who's wearing like Coke bottle glasses, and I just go, this guy just came out of the factory and already, we're having to buy accessories for him. So, it's not right. Like, so I think I'm thinking a lot about not so much mortality, but just sort of, that's the gradual decline.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
through life.
Yeah, you use your powers of denial and compartmentalization to get through it, to get through life, as everything kind of falls apart, not just with you, but your parents. And
yeah, exactly. I think something else that I'm also thinking about is that you've mentioned parents is just like, I didn't really think about how my dad lives alone, and my parents are divorced, and so my mum is remarried, but my dad lives alone. He has a partner, but she lives in Canberra. And because of the whole lockdown situation, my dad basically is by himself in his apartment. And a big part of his life, because he's 72, 73, a big part of his life is lunch with friends. That's kind of the highlight of his day. And he can't do that, can't see his girlfriend. And it was just sort of, it just suddenly occurred to me when I was speaking to him the other day that he's actually quite, I think he'd be okay with me saying this, but like he's depressed. He's depressed, and I think sort of, I don't know. I think I sort of take for granted that my parents are always going to be kind of chipper, and they're there to kind of lift my spirits. Like it was a moment of just like they need as much help. They need more help now, and you need to kind of be more in tune with and more caring and thinking about what they need. That was a bit of a wake up call. Yeah. And because I'm surrounded by people, I'm not conscious of other people's loneliness, but I'm becoming aware of it through the lockdown of especially with single friends who are really, I think in my head, I kind of go, I would watch so much TV and blah, blah, blah. And there is that, but it's pretty bleak.
Oh yeah. What do you consider your greatest achievement?
I mean, I guess like from a kind of career standpoint, I do feel really good that I got to work in the industry that I wanted to work in. Kind of, even if it sort of ended tomorrow, I think I would still have some, I'd be immensely sad, but I still have the satisfaction of, for one brief shining moment, I got to do the thing that I really set out to do. Because I think getting into this industry is so difficult. And there's so many elements, so many, you know, dominoes that need to line up. And I'm really, really lucky that they did line up for me, and that I got to experience, you know, what it's like to host a show on a commercial network, and I got to do the Logies and all that sort of stuff. So I feel, I guess for the younger version of myself that was too nervous to say, oh, I want to kind of go and do this sort of thing, I sort of feel I'm pleased for him. If that makes sense.
Brilliant, mate. That's lovely. Mark's experience of making sketches which appear online for The Roast, The Feed, and then 7:30 have netted him many, many millions of views. So he knows what it's like to truly go viral. I know it could be fleeting, but that rush that you must get when suddenly you got one of your videos getting 22 million views. I mean, that must be very exciting. I know you have to do a sketch the next day and everything. So you got 24 hours there where it must be pretty exciting, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest thrill with that was, so with this one called the Greta Thunberg Helpline. And it was just, as soon as it went out, within a minute of me putting a video on Twitter, I know exactly how well it's going to, you know, I know exactly how good that sketch is, you know.
Interesting, and
that was something where just the retweets just started pouring in like instantly. I was like, this is interesting, and it was just like I couldn't scroll fast enough to keep up with it. And then within 2 hours, I think Greta Thunberg retweeted it herself. And then it just blew, you know, wide open. But that was thrilling. But the sad reality, of course, about virality and all that sort of stuff is it doesn't really give you very much. It certainly doesn't give you much. I mean, there's no financial reward for it. I mean, hopefully it sort of builds, you know, it adds to your kind of general reputation and what have you. But I saw a tweet the other day. Do you see the video where it's a guy, he kind of, it's him transforming into things. He would sort of fall forwards towards the camera and then turn, like he'd be in a yellow outfit. He'd fall towards the camera and turn into a banana.
The video of a man transforming himself into everyday objects was made by the stop motion animator Kevin Parry and has been viewed more than 30 million times.
And he put out on Twitter, I think he said, this video has had 30 million views on Instagram and TikTok and Twitter and everything, all these sorts of things. And he said, and I haven't made a cent from it. And he's sort of like, he's not saying it in a bitter way. He's just saying this, the reality is that doesn't really equate to anything. So to any kids out there who kind of want to go viral or what have you, you need a set of skills and something to actually, this is not a, you know, this is not a path to riches, because I'd love to rest on my laurels. I'm so very keen to do that. And I'm ready. I'm ready. It's like, sometimes I do go like, how many more sketches do I have to make? Like, because I think we've made, like, across the years that we've been doing it at different places, I think we've made something. I can't even tell you the figure. It's something insane. It's like, I don't know, 700 sketches. It's something ridiculous. And the other thing I would just say about this generally, I think what's really interesting about the human psyche and I think something that's, again, a real weakness of the system, is that those things can go absolutely gangbusters, and you can have lovely, lovely, lovely comment after lovely comment. But my God, those things wash over you in a way that the negative stuff doesn't. And it's so fascinating that you can literally have 99 positive tweets, and that one negative one sometimes has that power to just go. I mean, maybe it's good in a way that's sort of humbling and doesn't allow you to get too big a head, but there is this feeling sometimes where it's like, oh God, that's the one person that can see through me. God, yeah,
that's exactly right. That's exactly right. They know, because we all feel, you know, we all feel like imposters.
Exactly.
Like whenever I get excited about a new show coming out, I get excited, and then I suddenly go, oh, that's right. That's going to happen. And you just brace yourself. And of course it happens. And you know, if you do a show on the ABC and you look at, and you stupidly look at their Facebook page, and you see all the boomers just like attacking you from their houses that they've bought with their franking credits. And just like the viciousness. It's like nothing you've ever seen. Like we won't, the human, you're talking about the human body being a vessel that's not able to kind of cope with life. I mean, we weren't, reading this stuff about ourselves wasn't part of the plan.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We weren't designed for this. There was no part of the evolutionary process that has accounted for this thing that we've created. And yeah, that is fascinating to me. And yeah, so the Facebook thing, like I don't read Facebook comments anymore because I just know that that's where Twitter, that's easier to manage because it's my page and people can come onto it. But Facebook, yeah, if it's the ABC's page, then yeah, your videos are going out to, you know, your stuff's going out to, I think they've got like, maybe the ABC News account has like 2 million followers or something like that. There's no way you're going to win that whole crowd over. No way.
No, and the ones you don't win are teeing off, you know. The ones you don't win over. Yeah, it's hardcore. Anyway, second last question. Who would you want on your side in a battle and why?
If it was a physical thing, because I would, like, I've always thought in the zombie apocalypse, I'm the first one to get eaten. Like, so my feeling is Andrew Rochford, okay, so my who I co-hosted Pointless with, I would actually, he is very... I'd love to, I think he'd be really good in a battle, in an actual physical battle.
Andrew Rochford won the block before TV producers called on his expertise as a medical doctor to appear opposite Sigrid Thornton on What's Good For You before hosting Breakfast on Channel 10, co-hosting the project, and then being appointed national medical editor for Channel 7. Then in 2018, he joined Mark as co-host on the quiz show Pointless.
Something very emotional occurred during the filming of an episode, and Andrew was... to the point where I was really struggling because it was something that a contestant had said completely innocently, but had just really affected me. And Andrew came to the, and basically Andrew went to the producers and said, I don't think you should. We had to film 5 episodes a day and we'd filmed 4. And this thing happened during the 4th episode. And Andrew went in to the producers and said, you can't make Mark go and do another episode after that. Now I'm going to cry because I just, sorry, it was very extremely thoughtful. And sorry, Adam, I wasn't expecting that.
Oh, you might, fine.
Gosh. He just, you know, and to shut down a TV production to send, oh gosh, you know, a crew of, I mean, everything, all the, I mean, it would have cost the network. I mean, I dread to think. Anyway, but he knew that for my mental health that I couldn't do another episode that night. I was just destroyed. And because it was actually 2 things back to back. Something had happened in episode 3 that I was very moved by. Something happened in episode 4, which was even more affecting. And Andrew got the production shut down. And he drove me home that night. And actually, we drove around for like an hour. And we just talked, and I'll always be grateful to him for that. And in a physical battle, if I did get wounded, he's a medical doctor. Not only could he hold his own, and you know, with an axe or a sword, I think he could also come to my aid when I get cut down. He was wonderful. He was anyway, and I think he'll be a friend for life. He was marvelous.
Yeah. The final question: what would you like your last words to be?
Thank you for the apology.
We have ignition sequence start.
Short distance, high impact.
5, 4, 3, 2, all engines running.
10 questions with Adam Zwar. Big names, great minds.
Make yourself a cup of tea.
Liftoff. We have liftoff.